GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software geeks in Western Russia who provide iOS and Android for mobile, machine-to-machine, and embedded software engineering. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
It is Saturday, February 15th, 2014. We're broadcasting live. You know what? It's the 22nd of February. This is KUSP on Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the minis and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Haven't been your host for a while, can you tell from the intro? In the Arum with me is Miles Elam, and Miles is a software engineer and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
Good morning on this Groundhog Day of Geek Speak.
Oh, we should start again, yes. Nicely done. So, and Mr. Ben Jaffe, a web development instructor, musician, and world traveler. Hey, Ben.
Hello.
Did you guys know that the views expressed on this show are not those of KUSP or its board, but of ours and ours alone, and not even the views of the companies we work for?
I will keep that in mind.
Good.
I don't work for a company.
You have nothing. So we can blame you for everything.
Yeah, he's actually good enough that he can employ himself.
You know, I do work for a company.
I'm
impressed. Thanks, Miles. That's wow.
Nice recovery from last week.
Miles is saying something nice about me. Something's wrong.
Well, last week he dogged on you for being a programmer.
Yeah, I was being extremely rude last week, and so I just wanted to make up for it because you do work hard. You are really good at your profession.
I appreciate it.
And I don't want the audience who doesn't know him and knows that we have this adversarial relationship off the air to get the wrong impression.
Yeah, the thing is, I just have trouble defending myself because I just don't have such a cutting sense of humor as you.
He's not a mean bastard like
I think that was the translation.
Even that's in nice. His statement. Yeah. Like,
it's nice you had to translate that into being mean.
Ben tries to be mean this week on Geek Speak.
Ben, what's up with the crazy money flows of internet technologies?
Have you heard of WhatsApp? WhatsApp,
rather? Yeah, like a chat application you use on your mobile device.
Yes, yes.
I ran into somebody on an airplane once, and when I was doing that whole travel to France all the time, and she's like, I'll be in France. I'm like, oh, yeah, what are you going to be doing? She's a photographer. I was like, oh, we should like find out what you're doing and get together. I'd love to see some of that stuff. Oh, okay. She's like, here, use this app. And this WhatsApp, and that's how I knew about it. But since then, I've never used it.
Yeah, I kind of want to channel old Budweiser commercials. WhatsApp.
Yeah, that's what it feels like to me.
Every time I hear that, every time I read it, I hear that in my head. It's a nice little earworm that I'm sharing with the rest of our listening audience.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, I'm going to link to the video that's that, but it's the Super Friends. That's an awesome video. All
right. Well, they have gotten acquired by Facebook. Now, why is this news? I don't use WhatsApp. It's so hard to say that to me. WhatsApp. Lyle has used it. Miles does not use it. So why is this news for us? Well, they got acquired by Facebook for $16 billion, which is...
with $3 billion more promised as options, yeah.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. What do they have besides a kind of annoying name?
They do have
they have half a billion users.
They have 450 million users, which is a good number of users. And my guess, I don't know if this is actually true, but my guess is that a lot of the people who use WhatsApp don't use Facebook as much. They use WhatsApp instead of Facebook in a lot of situations to communicate with people, to organize things. So that makes WhatsApp a big competition for Facebook, potentially.
And it'll be curious to see how it plays out because WhatsApp had been very much a you're going to pay for our app after the free period is over. You're going to have
to
pay.
Yeah, it was a year free and then some small amount per year.
But we're never going to show ads to you or sell your information to third parties, which is in stark contrast to how Facebook's model works, which is
we'll do ads,
but we won't make you pay for anything.
Yeah, and that really does make me curious. Like, why was it – what's – the people who run WhatsApp are so anti-corporate advertising, which is completely the opposite of the way Facebook seems to run. So it just seems like a strange acquisition to me. Beyond that, if you look at the $19 billion that WhatsApp is going to be acquired for by Facebook, that is actually the second biggest tech acquisition ever. So if you were to adjust all of the acquisitions over all the years for inflation, Compaq was bought by Hewlett Packard in 2001 for what's now adjusted $33.4 billion. That's a lot of money. WhatsApp is $19 billion. And then everything else you've ever heard of as being acquired by some other company or Google or Facebook, less than that $19 million or billion dollars.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. Skype was $3 billion.
Yeah. And something that just blows my mind and has been mentioned online in the forums that I frequent, WhatsApp is considered a chatting app.
Yes, it's chat app.
Was considered three times more valuable than Sun Microsystems.
But Sun Microsystems has like buildings.
Yeah.
But I mean, not just that, but I mean, Sun Microsystems is the creator of Java and a lot of networking technology, and they had their own hardware infrastructure and their own operating system. It just blows my mind.
I do have to correct myself. Skype was acquired in 2005 for $3 billion and in 2011, most recently by Microsoft, for $9 billion.
Right, it went up, right?
But still, that's half the price of this.
So John Gomm, which is the current CEO of WhatsApp, he says, this is a quote from him, "What's going to change for you, our customers? Nothing. WhatsApp will remain autonomous and operate independently," which is... okay, sure, but then why would Facebook buy it? Now, Facebook, of course, is an advertising company, and that's where all the revenue is. WhatsApp is a paid-for service, and their current fee is, after the first year of free, it's $1 a year. And so the question is that really sustainable in an advertising market? I mean, if you think about the amount of users at $1, a fee of 450 million users, and it's $1 a year, that's not a lot of revenue.
Yeah. Well, they're buying the users, but it's also my take on it is that Facebook is having the cake and eating it too. In other words, they have their own model, then they have this alternative model, and they can run both in parallel and take whichever preference the users have. The only question I would have is whether or not they follow through with keeping them completely independent, and so that if you use one, that your data doesn't flow to the other.
If they keep them completely independent, how would Facebook recoup that revenue? Or is it just they have so much money, all they need to do is get rid of a competitor? It doesn't even matter if they have to run the service.
I think it's more the latter.
It's incredible. Mm-hmm. Now, with this service, WhatsApp is very clearly like doesn't collect a lot of information. You can use the application, pay for it and stuff without them having much data about you at all. And that's very different than Facebook's model as well. It's just incredible. I think it would have been more incredible, of course, if WhatsApp had been offered to be purchased for $19 million or 16 plus other options and had said no, which we've seen also with HipChat. They said no to giant amounts of money.
Right. And bear in mind, we're not saying anything bad about the WhatsApp group. I mean, hey, you got $19 billion. Good on you.
Yeah. Like,
and from what I hear, they're very hard workers and very good programmers.
Yeah.
That's nothing against them about that. We're
sure,
just talking about the insanity of the whole situation.
As is everybody. So let's move on. Let's talk about online identities. Would we, Miles? Would you mind?
Yes. One of the things that people worry about are online predators, people who are masquerading as teens and tweens, adult, usually men.
Mm. That's our fear. Yes.
Yes.
Especially as parents of young children.
But as it turns out, and watching tweets, for example, if you're pretending to be, and it may not be because of predators. It may also be because you want to hit a certain marketing segment.
Sure.
So you'll try to pretend that you're the hip 16-year-old so that other 16-year-olds will go like, hey.
No, you're the hip 16-year-old, so the 13-year-olds will buy what you're buying.
Yes. Okay, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, as it turns out, computers, if they take a corpus of all of your tweets, can actually look at the pattern and see what your age and gender are be able to pick out, like, wait a second, you're not actually a 16-year-old girl. You're a 40-year-old man.
Yeah, great.
So that takes away my secondary form of income.
selling cosmetics to 13-year-olds.
Yeah.
So they're doing this by just analyzing the language patterns or the topic points or a bit of both? Or are they just doing a giant sample and algorithmically?
A bit of both, but yeah, you're taking all that, and then you're looking at patterns, and they may not be patterns that we as humans recognize, or yeah. at least you know,
it's interesting when you talk about artificial intelligence and how it actually works, the fuzzy logic systems at work, you can't actually translate it into English. It's a pattern of learning and reinvestigating that is algorithmic in nature, and that's how it's defined.
Right. And so we can also remember
a metaphor for it.
Yeah, but. For example, if we were, I can't impersonate a 16-year-old girl. I probably never could. But if I could, if I were to impersonate a 16-year-old boy, I might be tempted to look back at my old writings from when I was in high school,
right,
and try to recreate that or copy it verbatim. Except that my experience as a 16-year-old years ago is different from the 16-year-olds today. They're going to use different language. So even if I'm trying to if I put my 16-year-old self today, put it on Twitter, it would get called out as saying, wait a second, you're not an actual
16-year-old. That's 2 dozen years old.
Right.
So, okay, that's pretty cool, I have to say. So online impersonation can be detected, and that makes complete sense. You know, speaking of our teens or early, go see Ghostbusters. So I watched Ghostbusters with the kids last night. It was so much fun. But this is why I couldn't impersonate somebody this age, because I'd be quoting Ghostbusters all the time.
I like their theme.
Yeah. It's a fun movie.
Now, it's going to be stuck in my head all day, you know.
All right. So online impersonation doesn't work. But what about physical impersonation of human parts?
Well, we've been talking about 3D printers for years and years now. And using 3D printers for all sorts of things, from creating coffee mugs and things like that to actually creating body parts and synthesizing body parts. So I have two quick stories. One is a follow-up story. 3 years ago, they made a 3D printed pelvis. It was actually a large portion of pelvis for this man who had bone cancer and lost a lot of his pelvis. And 3 years later...
But the interesting story about that is that they imaged his other half of his pelvis, and then they created one that matched perfectly, 3D printed one that matched perfectly, and then pulled out the bad bone and put in the good
bone. Other words, the only truly symmetrical human being in the world.
Well, at least his pelvis. He's
and
very hip.
Printed out of titanium. So 3D titanium pelvis.
Right.
The man's still just hanging out with his pelvis.
Do you remember the story about the woman who got her jaw replaced by 3D printing titanium?
Yeah.
Same story. Went in, it was a one-day process, and she had a new jaw printed 3D, and it matched her old one.
I thought you were going to say, same story. That man and woman got... What?
Different people, but same process. Yes.
Anyway, so wonderful to hear that 3D printed pelvises and 3D printed body parts actually can work. And 3 years later, we see that it's still working great.
Cool.
So also this company has named Exobionics. Talk about a robotic name. So they've actually created a 3D printed robotic suit for this woman. And it's custom printed to her exact physiology and everything. She actually...
Is this just so she's cool and can participate with Sony?
This is
Sony
so she
Weaver
has
attacking
like super
aliens?
Robotic strength and can jump really high.
Why does she need an exoskeleton?
She actually became paralyzed after a skiing incident.
Oh my gosh.
Years and years ago. Back in 1992.
So this doesn't look cool. This moves too.
Yeah. So 22 years later, this woman who for 22 years thought she wasn't going to be able to walk again, now can actually walk with the help of this exoskeleton. It's really cool.
How is she controlling it?
You know, that's something I'm not exactly sure. The articles
Siri,
don't have,
please move forward.
This, unfortunately, is not open source. Okay. You know, you can't just figure out. There's some information in... There are numerous articles about this story.
Oh,
and they all have different bits of information. I'll put one of them up on the Geek Speak site.
Awesome.
It's really strange, though, because watching her walk, like the bottom half of her is controlled by a robot, basically.
Yeah.
Right? So she's got canes, but then the bottom half of her, I don't know if it's just that her bottom half looks more like a robot,
mm-hmm.
or if it's actually because it's controlled by a robot, but it's
a
little bit freaky.
She's a paraplegic, so that means that probably as she moves herself along with her canes, her legs will keep her upright and mm-hmm. move her forward, right?
Yeah, so I don't think
kind
she's
of
doing...
like riding a Segway in the sense that you just have to move your body, shift weight, and it will compensate.
Maybe.
Pretty cool. All right. Well, thanks
for
the story. I think it makes a lot of sense. We're going to see more augmented bodies in that nature. I'm glad we're doing it first for the purpose of making people be able to move around, not just, you know,
Yeah, they're pretty pictures too on
this story. In a minute we're going to talk a little bit about online trolls and the new technology around the Olympics. But first, we're going to take a quick break, so stay with us here on Geek Speak. One nation, united in fun. If you think fun is merely frivolous, historian John Beckman begs to differ. He says rebellious rivalry is an essential ingredient of American democracy. He talks to KOSP's Robert Pauley about the long history of subversive American fun, from the 17th century proto-hippie commune of Mary Mount to Ken Kesey's Merry Pranksters. That's tomorrow here on KOSP. On KOSP right now is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. We'll be taking calls in about 15 minutes. If you'd like to give us a ring and ask us questions about technology or let us know something, the phone number is 800-655-5877. Again, that phone number is 800-655-5877. We'll take any questions you'd like. Ben, tell us something we have to see up on Geek Speak in a Geek Bit segment.
I will when I find it. Oh, evolution of cell phone video. That's right. There's a fantastic video that just shows a kind of a vector art kind of approach to all of the different cell phones from basically the last 40 years. It's really fun to watch the years tick by and watch. And then the iPhone pops up. And then there's all these different Android devices. They're constantly changing, and the iPhone's just staying, like, not changing at all.
That's cool.
It gets a little taller. Yeah. And, you know.
All right, cool. So film about all the different cell phones that have been available.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
That'll be up on GeekSpeak in a few minutes. I'll make an episode page and link to it in just a minute. But first, let's go ahead and hear from Miles about... Whose turn was it? I'm sorry.
Miles.
Good. Miles, trolls?
Yes.
What's a troll?
Yeah, what is a troll? They live in the bridges.
A troll in this case is someone who makes a comment online for the sole purpose of fostering discontent.
And conversation about the discontent.
Yes, but yeah. I mean that's the whole thing, is to say something provocative so that people go like, what? I can't believe you believe that. You know, and take umbrage and then watch the fireworks fly. That's a definition of an online troll in this particular case. And folks have done some research on this and found that when examining the personalities of online trolls versus other populations, like for people that just read online materials but don't comment, or others that like to substantively debate issues, folks who are just on there for social reasons, you know, trolls, it turns out, have a very high index for sadism, among other things.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, it seems to make sense. But what do you mean?
But something that we may consider intuitive is not something that can be objectively measured and shown and demonstrated to say, yes, they are, you know, 0.6 points of standard deviation.
Right. No, I get that. We feel like
Machiavellianism or narcissism or being, you know, a psychopath.
Right. We think that way, but we don't have any kind of scientific proof that that's the case.
Yes. And so if you enjoy trolling, then chances are you are someone who is a sadist.
How can you say that? Just because the study says that that's probably true?
Yeah, there is a strong correlation. Yes. Correlation is not causation, but there is a strong correlation between the two.
All right. Does that... Okay.
Hmm.
It feels like you're just trolling trolls right now. It's common in chat environments when somebody actually... Or in online, you know, forum environments, when someone says something that clearly... The only thing you can do to respond to that is want to respond to it, and it feels like you have to counter the argument. That's probably trolling.
I'm reminded of the comic, "Honey, come to bed." No, I can't. There's someone who's wrong on the internet, right?
Yes,
that is the response to the troll. Yes, yeah, so that mm-hmm. you have to respond to them, which gives rise to the term "don't feed the trolls." But right. thanks to the internet, you have a huge audience, and
yeah,
yeah.
So
yeah.
This Winter Olympics, I've noticed that the footage is incredible. What the heck's going on, Ben?
Drones.
Flying creatures.
So we hear a lot about drones in terms of the military, you know, and drone strikes and all
and Amazon
that.
Delivering packages.
Amazon delivering packages. Basically, drone just means a flying thing that's smaller than an aircraft, generally unmanned, or actually, I think by definition, unmanned. So this is not necessarily a news story, but it's an interesting thing to talk about. There was a story actually this week about it, so I'm linking that up on the GeekSpeak page. And it's just talking about using drones, especially quadcopters, and I guess would they be called octocopters if they have eight propellers? They're these little helicopters, but they're symmetrical, and they've got either four or three or eight propellers.
Sure.
Okay. And you attach a camera to them, and you can remote control the camera, and there's a transmitter and everything. So they're using these things in all sorts of ways. They're using them for sports videos. They're using them for football games. They're using them for the Olympics as well. They're just the footage that they can create is just mind-blowing. Yeah. And you see it in terms of sports, but there are also a lot of artistic uses of it as well. Like there's this one video that they have, it's actually on the article that I'm linking to, where the drone is kind of following this guy who's running, and it kind of looks almost like a crane shot, but then it just keeps going further and further up and away and away and away. And this is just a shot that you would not be able to get unless you have a drone. And
Good skills with CGI.
Or good skills with CGI, that's true. And I just, from a cinematic point of view, from a film cinematography point of view, I love how it breaks open the set of paradigms of like what kinds of shots we can have, you know?
Yeah.
You have the close-up shot, you've got the moving shot, you've got the crane shot, and now we've got any other shot you ever could want. Like, and they're also cheaper, you know? Like the most expensive ones are like maybe $40,000, $50,000.
Oh, but, let me pick up two.
But I mean, that's so much cheaper than renting a helicopter for
or a crane shot. I mean, a large crane even. You know, a traditional crane for video work costs a lot of money too now.
Yeah.
And of course it's trapped down to the ground and you can't do some things with it.
Yeah,
pretty cool. I love drones. I'm totally into them. Fun stuff.
Yeah, when they don't have guns attached.
Yes.
Those drones are great.
It's actually not the drone that I've got the problem with, it's the other thing, the other machine on there.
Yeah, that's
hey
true.
You know, I was planning on taking calls a little bit later, but we got a call that kind of matches up with this in some way. So Jim from Gilroy, welcome back to GeekSpeak. What's your question today?
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I had a question. I purchased a Droid Ultra.
Okay. And yeah.
Excuse me?
Yeah, go on.
Oh, okay. So I bought it only because of the different applications on it, as far as visual, being able to enlarge the print and whatnot because of my visual issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a issue with texting. So does this phone, because I've been scrolling through the different applications, and I haven't been able to find anything concerning where the phone would read you an incoming text.
Read it to you? You mean?
Yeah, I had an old cell phone, a dinosaur, and it had the capability to read back the incoming text.
Okay.
So now I do have an option for a doc reader, but it doesn't apply
to the text messages. Yeah, that's right.
Right.
There are a number of apps. Actually, one great thing about having devices like this is that they're often built with accessibility in mind. So you can install, there's an app called Google Text to Speech, which you can install. And I believe that contains another app called TalkBack, and that's an accessibility feature on Android phones, which will let you have the phone read things out to you, which makes it easier to get the content.
He doesn't have to root the phone for this?
No.
Okay.
No, you can install that from the Google Play Market, I believe. And it may have different names depending on how old or new your phone is. I'm not familiar with your specific phone. So if you can't find what I'm bringing up, Google Text-to-Speech or TalkBack in the Google Play Store, you could also just search Google for your phone and then accessibility. And then you'll get details on how to enable accessibility on your phone.
Hey, Jim, thank you so much for calling. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right. Miles, let's get an update before the next phone call. Let's get an update on some home technology.
Yes, all those home routers that we have, specifically a lot of ones from Linksys, but many other vendors as well. I believe Belkin has also shown up as well, have gaping holes of insecurity. They are not general purpose computers like we would think about, but they do have CPUs, they do have RAM, they do have software on them. And if there is any problem with them, they would still need security updates. Unfortunately, most of them don't get security updates. There are some routers, for example, that have never been updated. For example, you bought them in 2005, and then you never updated the firmware.
Yeah, that's a not
because
an
most people
thing.
Plug it in and then you forget about it and don't do anything about it. This is one area where I actually like the Apple routers because they have that blinking light. You're like, why is the thing blinking? And then you take a look and goes like, oh, the router needs to have
an update available.
Yeah, firmware. Most routers don't have that. They have no indicator that you need to be updating, and most people wouldn't be comfortable with updating their firmware in the first place, even if they knew that it was needed. Well, now chickens are coming home to roost, and a lot of these routers are getting rooted. And
Which means that somebody else besides you starts taking ownership of the router.
Right. And many of the stories have actually been ones of routers that have been displaying a message saying, hey, I got into your system, but it wasn't someone who was trying to cause any malicious damage. It was more of a, I got on, you need to deal with this.
Right.
But if you haven't already, update the firmware on your home router. If you don't know how to, it behooves you to find someone who can answer that question.
Yeah, it really does. It's time.
And it's different for each router.
It's time to make dinner for somebody and invite them over and ask them to give you 20 minutes. Because updating a router is not actually that hard to do because you have to visit the router with a web browser from inside your network. And then after that, you have to log in, which means you have to know how to get access to it. And then after that, you've got to do basically an update. It's not that hard. It's very common to update your computer, really. But it's a little risky, and it might be some loss.
Some routers are easier than others. Some routers, for example, you have to download the firmware first and upload it from your computer. Other routers will just do it directly from the internet. And so you really do need to have someone who has at least some technical expertise or some experience doing this to help you out with it.
On your routers, do you run Tomato?
DDWRT.
These are firmwares that are open source firmwares. So the company that actually made the router isn't providing the operating system for these routers. Miles and I are actually using open source projects. But I haven't updated mine in a while, which is probably a problem.
But another issue, though, is that if you have a router and you have been updating it, you're pretty much okay.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these vulnerabilities have been patched already.
Right.
It's if you bought the router
and never did
7
anything.
Years ago, 8 years ago, something like that, and then you never touched it
sometimes.
Again.
I mean,
the
security news I hear is continual amazement to me at what problems.
Right, security
emerge
is a continuum. It's not a binary. You're secure or you're not.
And the other thing you want to do is while you're doing any of this kind of stuff, updating your computer, doing backups, anything that takes some time from your day and therefore is going to be a deterrent doing it again. Make sure to make a really clear log of what you do. So then in 3 months or something, or 6 months again, you go, oh, I haven't done that in a while. You can go back to that log and just follow those steps again. Write your password down for your router and your admin password stuff information after you figure it out or after you reset it, and keep it in a drawer in your file cabinet. The people that want to get access to your house are not going to break into your file cabinet to find the password, right?
And, well, there's also another bright side to this, which is if you haven't updated your router, it means you probably don't have a very complex network. In fact,
yes.
You have a dead simple network, which means that even if you've forgotten the password, resetting the router to its factory defaults is trivially easy.
There's a little button on the bottom normally, and then that just sets it to the default.
Yeah, you press and hold for like 15 seconds.
The only trick here when you're doing this is sometimes after you've done this, you don't have internet access, right? So you've got this kind of catch-22.
Which is why you need to have someone who knows how to do this.
So the step you do first actually is while your network is working, you find your router model information, and then you go get the file from that, you download it. And then after that, you do the process. So at least you have a copy of it. Or have a second computer or like a phone that has network.
Yeah. And actually, I think I was going too far. You don't necessarily need to find someone. But before you start it, just like you were saying, look up your router version because there will be instructions on how to update it.
Yeah.
And
oh, follow those instructions.
Yeah, especially if you're one of those folks that's inclined this way, print them out ahead of time
because
you won't be able to have access to the internet after that.
I love that, or at least have a text file on your computer. I love the idea that it's novel. You could follow their instructions. Like, I never follow their instructions.
Right. After 5 minutes.
Read the VCR instructions? No, I am always blinking 12.
Rick suggests, and make sure that you can find the log 6 months later, right? So what I was saying is when you make a log of what you did, print that out and put it in a file cabinet because then you have a folder. Like when I go to help out somebody.
That way you have even more stuff that you can't access in your file cabinet.
No, I'm saying you print it. What I'm saying is that when I visit, you know, a family friend, I'm trying to help them out. And I say, okay, where's your ISP information, like your password stuff? You know, I need that information to help you here. And they're like, the people that I just love and have a wonderful time and enjoy the entire evening are the people that pull the full folder out of their file cabinet that have their passwords written down and their router numbers and anything that ever came from their ISP or from the company that gave them their modem, whatever. When it's all in one place, I'm like, okay, this is going to be easy. Thank you.
Okay.
It's the times when they go, oh, what? I go, okay, let's inspect your machine. And then it's hours of figuring things out. So printing things out is really useful. Put it in a folder because it's really nice if you have that organized. Okay, let's move on. Should we take another call or should we go off to Bugs and Hardware? Bugs and Hardware is so tempting, but you know
what? Let's do a call.
First, let's take a call. So Bugs and Hardware in a second. Will you promise it'll be fun, Ben?
I can. Well, fun. Sure.
Sure. Ida in Santa Cruz, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. I have a PC, and I have done research on the internet and all that, but I am an older person that gets pretty nervous about, you know, the different passwords, about attachments, that sort of freaks me out. And I'm looking for someone that is willing, of course, for a fee, to give me lessons once a week. And you guys, anyone, I would love to have you come to my home. I live downtown.
In Santa Cruz? Okay, so, well, let's make the call. We none of us do that service right now, but we do have listeners that do that service. And I know of one company, actually a person that's been on the show many times, Jesse Wilkins. So Jesse Wilkins does that kind of service. There's also a community center at Loudoun Nelson. Loudoun Nelson Community Center.
I want someone to come here.
Yeah, so I'm just letting you know that there is that kind of service for people that might want to travel a bit. And Loudoun, of course, is downtown Santa Cruz. The Cabrillo... Cabrillo College has an amazing program for this kind of services too, to just learn basic technology. We've had the people that run that facility on over the years on GeekSpeak a few times. So I want to point generally everybody to those different features of our community. Gray Bears also has training facilities and things as well. But if you want someone to your home, I can recommend Jesse Wilkins, and I can also invite any geeks that are in the greater Monterey Bay area, Central Coast California area, that will do these kind of service. Let the geeks know, and we will make sure to connect you up with people that have this kind of issue and needs. So please do email the geeks.
Do you need
at
my telephone number?
No, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to take your phone number on the air because that means millions or thousands of people will be able to hear you. But I will definitely mention it next week if anybody calls in or during this show if anybody calls in. So the phone number to call in is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Or geeks that do this kind of service, please email us as well. We are geeks@geekspeak.org. And of course, you can learn more about us and the show and everything up at geekspeak.org. And if I do find people, I will add to today's show. And today is February 22nd.
What about Jesse Wilkins? Can I get in touch with him?
Yes. If you do a web search for Jesse Wilkins, so sorry, I can't give you more information right now. He's definitely online, Jesse Wilkins. And you know what? I'll mention at the end of the show when I find his information. Thank you for calling in.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Keep listening.
Bye.
All right, Ben. Hardware?
Bugs. Okay, so, yeah, the reason I was tentative on saying it would be fun is because this is actually about a systems failure in a Toyota Camry, 2005 Toyota Camry. In September of 2007, there was a fatal car accident, and it wasn't... Basically, the accelerometer got stuck is what they were thinking. But it turns out it wasn't a rug that was sticking the accelerator or anything like that. So after a lot of investigation, they actually found that it was a critical software bug.
So a true runaway process.
A true runaway.
I'm sorry. I couldn't let that one go by. This is a serious topic.
Yes. Well, anyway, so basically it was because of a Stack Overflow. So
I just realized the time. Stack Overflow, runaway car. Everyone, we understand the technology. We're going to talk about it more. Stay with us here on Geek Speak. This car has a software problem and doesn't decelerate anymore.
Yeah, the accelerator is stuck. Here's the quote. It said, due to recursion overwriting critical data past the end of the stack and into the real-time operating system memory area, the throttle, the accelerometer, was left in an open state and the process that controlled the throttle was terminated.
No!
That's really bad news.
So you've got a software package that goes, oh, they want to accelerate, and it starts the acceleration.
Oh, they want to stop accelerating anymore.
Stops
yeah.
accelerate. Yeah. So when it wants to accelerate, now I'm no longer functional. There's no way to stop it.
Yeah, it's the connection between the pedal that you push with your foot and the engine and the things that make the engine go faster or slower.
This is the danger of drive-by wire.
It seems like a bad idea to put something non-mechanical. In some way, to me, it seems like a bad idea to put something that's not just simply mechanical in mm-hmm. between your feet and the actual functions of the car.
Okay.
Right? If you go back to the Model T, for example, you know, like, there's no
and no one ever died in the Model T.
But what I'm saying is, when you took it apart, you could see exactly how it worked. You can see this rod connects to this, which connects to that,
so
which makes more gas.
You're arguing for transparency in how the system works.
Right, and you could have this with like a Geo Metro or whatever the current compact car is. But if you want
dating Miles again.
Yes.
Miles' first car was a Geo Metro.
Yes.
One less cylinder than you need. Go on.
One cylinder fewer, but that's a whole other.
Oh, man. Beaten.
Hey, if you're going to come after me, man.
Okay, our stack is pretty high now. We've got to climb back down the stack. Miles, go.
But at the same time, unless you have these drive-by-wire systems, you're not going to get the efficiency gains we've had in recent years, not mm-hmm. to mention the handling, the things like anti-lock brakes require
this kind of thing,
fly-by-wire system.
Yeah. And I would argue that, in fact, we all know that the human interaction time is actually not very good. And so as computer systems are helping to control the car, they can react faster and safer than we can. Anti-lock brakes are a perfect example of... Mm-hmm.
But there does need to be some type of override, like when you grab an emergency brake, that it cuts off that fly-by-wire and does engage something that...
Yeah. I agree.
That cuts off throttle, for example.
Sure.
Where's the line, though? Because this is all... It seems simpler to say, oh, yeah, mechanical, that's good. Computer, that could be bad. But no, I mean, what if the guy who made the rod that connects the emergency brake to the actual brake, what if they made it defectively? I mean, ultimately, yes. We're really talking about human error in all of these situations, right?
Right. We're the ones that create things.
So well, someone basically wrote some code that seemed okay to everybody, got past all of their inspections and tests and all their review, and ended up being an issue in a very unusual situation.
Sure.
Right? This doesn't happen to tons of cars.
I think your intuition of, wait, I like the Model T because I can see everything that happens. I know exactly what's going on. That's talking about transparency in how the manufacturing process happens.
It's two
Unfortunately,
things.
Once you go into software and you do compile and you do microchips, you don't have introspection to that.
Yeah.
That's why I think we should actually mandate open source much higher up the stack, especially for control systems like this.
Yeah.
There should be an ability for just not the people that make money off the product, but the people that actually own the product to know exactly how it works.
There are also many studies that have shown that the software development practices in embedded systems, like, for example, in the automotive industry, are very different from the software practices in the general tech mm-hmm. industry.
That's right.
For example, the extensive use of global variables everywhere a lot of spaghetti code.
Well,
but, so it's complicated. It's not
yes,
as
it
simple.
Is.
Yeah.
And to bring some folks into it, I'm just going to give a nice metaphor. I'm sorry for any geeks who think I may have oversimplified this, but this is just for all those folks who are non-coders, you can understand what's going
on. Yeah, what's a buffer overflow?
Or a stack overflow. So you're at a table with a few other people and you're drawing pictures.
Okay.
And each of those people is a program that's running
On the table.
On the system.
On the table. The,
the table is the whole computer, and each piece of paper with each artist or the like is a process, is a program.
Okay.
And one of those programs, their job is drawing spirals. And I'm going to call the spiral the recursive program.
Oh, I'm not. That's me.
Yeah. So,
yeah, and it was.
So you start drawing that spiral on your desk, and it starts getting bigger and bigger. But you're always expecting that you're never going to draw that spiral more than 10 seconds at a time.
Right, and then you start over.
Then you start over. And so the spiral never gets that big, and you're like, okay, that's fine. I can deal with that. And you get to the end of the spiral, and you just trace right back to the center, and there you have whatever function you're trying to do. The Stack Overflow is you're drawing the spiral, and you keep going. For some reason, you never hit that timer. You never hit that end state. So you keep drawing that spiral, and that spiral
bigger
ends up drawing
bigger.
Off onto someone else's piece of paper. And now their drawing gets completely messed up.
Yes.
And then two things happen. One, they notice and they say, hey, wait a second, I should start my drawing over again.
Or it affects their work.
That's what should happen. That would be like a failure, and then the system catastrophically fails and reboots, and it takes like a quarter of a second or half a second or something. Or they don't notice, and it impacts their drawing.
Right.
That's what happened here.
Well, the other thing, in the operating system sometimes can say, hey, that application has done something outside the scope of what it's supposed to do, and kill the application.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing that can occur.
Yeah, so the
process. And of course, if you're controlling a throttle shifting, you know, whether it's less and more, and you kill the application that does that, it can no longer do that function.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, many embedded systems don't have the same protections that modern operating systems do, like the ones on your desktop or even on your phone have. They tend to be more limited in resources, and so won't, you know, memory goes from one program to another, and you just kind of and there's nothing that really stops that effectively.
Right. And Ben, that's where you're saying that you were talking about the whole system rebooting. It actually can happen really fast because there's not a lot of infrastructure in the application stack.
Yeah, the article says at 60 miles an hour, you go 11 feet in the amount of time the entire system takes to reboot. So it reboots really, really fast.
Yeah. So does that mean that this isn't actually dangerous for people? Because it reboots, it's okay? Or has there been accidents from it?
There was the one accident.
What's the vehicle?
Well, the problem was that it didn't reboot, right? The problem was
exactly.
That,
it was a Toyota Camry. It was a 2005 Toyota Camry. If you have a 2005 Toyota Camry, you're probably just fine. Probably.
So
you
need to get a firmware upgrade, right? Just like the routers.
Right, just like the routers you were talking about.
Wow. And they do that. When you go into the shop and have your car worked on, they will update microcontroller processing systems. Sometimes.
Yeah.
If they know about the bug.
So that was the problem, was that if it had said, hey, wait a second, if the accelerometer program had died and taken the whole system with it, that would have been much better than what happened. It died silently, and then, you know, things were talking to it and taking instructions from it, but it wasn't there anymore.
You know,
and so the pass-through never happened.
How do you know if your car has this problem?
Well, my guess is that probably a good portion of cars have this problem or a similar problem. we like to think that we're safe, but I mean,
keep in mind, Ben likes to bike and take public transit a lot. I wonder why.
Well, then again, buses might have this problem.
That's not cool, man.
So
do that.
I know we've been talking about this for a while. I just want to point out, though, that there are two discussions to be had. One is the things maybe should be a bit more open source, so that way there's more transparency. The other thing is, as things get more and more complicated, things get more and more difficult to understand. And that's not just for example, me and my car. I don't understand most of what goes on in my car. But also the people who build them and the people who write the software, right? So the more complicated these systems get, the more difficult it becomes to understand all of it, and the more likely it becomes to accidentally put in little errors here and there that are difficult to test for. So that's the other side of it. That's why I like the Model T, right?
Which is why the software industry uses unit tests, and they have...
True.
And they stop doing things like using extensive numbers of global variables. And,
So we have ways of dealing with these issues, but... There's still issues.
So from our caller, Ida, who wants somebody to visit her home, I looked up Jesse Wilkins. Jesse Wilkins actually owns and operates Computer Center of Santa Cruz, and he's available on SoCal Drive, 5372 SoCal Drive. But here's the phone number to call Jesse's shop, and he does do on-site and in-store repair. And I'm giving out the phone number because I know him and he does the service. Other geeks are welcome to do that. In fact, Ida, there's another somebody else that does that service. If you email us at geeks@geekspeak.org. We'll connect you up. The other person can hook you up and help you as well. And you can try Computer Center of Santa Cruz County, and the phone number is 831-464-7262. All right, let's move on with another call, shall we? Because it's on topic, I believe. Talking about Toyotas having technical difficulty. Chris, what's up with you?
Hi. I was in a car accident.
I'm sorry to hear that.
About 3 years ago. And when you guys were talking about the throttle, the malfunction in the computer, they looked at the data recorder after the accident.
Yep.
The seatbelts didn't lock and the airbags didn't deploy.
The seatbelts are computer controlled? I thought they were mechanically controlled.
Well, I know. That's why I'm calling, because...
Huh. What year vehicle was your Toyota?
It was an 07, I believe.
07. I
it
can't...
It was the first year.
It doesn't make a lot of sense to have intuitively, I don't think of seatbelts as having electronic control for locking mechanisms, though they do seem to ratchet a bit. But I think that's all mechanical.
But then again, it may be mechanical, and just the sensor saw that it didn't ratchet. It may just be
that there might be a sensor on the actual system that locked, so it knows that it didn't ratchet. It could be that mechanically it doesn't always ratchet, it doesn't always lock down. I mean, it's just a physical property. If you have the right kind of bump, I'm assuming that locking mechanism doesn't do. Interesting. 2007.
I think that was the first year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
anyway.
it's possible that they're also computer controlled, because these types of computers don't tend to fail very often. And so maybe there are some situations in which they could lock the seatbelts where the actual mechanical mechanism wouldn't lock, but it could be beneficial for the passenger. Yeah. So I'm not sure. I mean, that would be something that I did a quick Google search. I didn't find it. But
there's patents on the system of mechanical or electrical.
And so then there's just sensors for the airbags themselves.
Mm-hmm. The sensors themselves, the airbag sensor themselves are actually, I think, part of the actual package. It's the airbag detects the momentum and then fires.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, but, I just thought, hey, maybe I finally have an answer to why they
safety security systems like the airbag and the seatbelts, you really don't want any time for processing information on it, right? You want as minimal as possible. You want them very self-contained. Imagine that, you know, for some reason the wire that goes to the seatbelt to the central processing unit, which is, you know, somewhere else in the car, imagine that wire is problematic. All of a sudden you have no more functional seatbelt. So you really want to get the smarts of that extremely close to the actual mechanism itself.
Yeah. Perfect sense.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Well, thanks. Okay, take it easy. Thanks, guys.
And I would like to make a minor point about this, which is that I can't speak for you guys, but I personally am not against electronic systems in cars, not because I think they're foolproof, but because purely mechanical cars aren't foolproof either. There really isn't anything, and I think that more lives and property have been saved by having these electrical systems that sense different scenarios, like airbags and like anti-lock brakes, that have saved more lives than they have harmed.
Yeah. And stability control stuff too.
Want to get that out there.
Yeah. Well, so Ben, that was Ben's story about hardware malfunctioning and causing a runaway vehicle. Miles, do you have any larger objects that are runaway?
Slightly larger.
Okay.
But only slightly, because it is a neutron star and those tend to be fairly small.
Neutron stars are small. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, in diameter. Density, they're quite large though. But it turns out that NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory found a very fast-moving neutron star. Now, a neutron star is formed when a red giant collapses. And then basically the gravity, it shoots off the outer layers. And the portion that remains, that stellar core, ends up being so dense and the gravity so extreme that you'd no longer have distinct atoms anymore. You have this mix of protons and electrons that have pushed together to make neutrons. So you just have there just isn't any room for discrete atoms anymore. It's just a neutron soup.
Yeah, so these things, like their giant red, the star expands really big into a red giant, and then at some point, if the mass is great enough and the expansion didn't happen too quickly, it collapses back down, throwing ejecta everywhere.
Once the fusion reaction slows down and it can't keep the outer layers out anymore, that's where the...
Right. Not all red dwarfs do that. Our sun probably won't turn into a neutron star.
It definitely won't.
It'll just envelop the Earth. It's not big enough. But a neutron star, at the end, you have a small, dense star.
Wait, what about this one? Runaway. Tell me more about that part.
Yes. So when that star collapses and there is an explosion, many times there will be a spin. That's where we get a pulsar. and it may have a wobble because that explosion will not happen directly at the center, like at the center of mass. Mm. Well, this particular one, IGR J11014-6103.
I know it well.
Yes, our old friend, had its explosion happen so far off the center of mass that it shot off in a particular direction.
It's like a rocket. Like neutron rocket.
Well, except that we don't have any rockets that go this fast.
Oh.
How fast?
It's going 8 kilometers per hour.
Wait, what?
No. That's really slow.
That's slow. 8 kilometers per hour?
No, I'm sorry.
Try that again.
Sorry.
8 million?
8 million kilometers per hour.
That uppercase M eluded you again. 8 million kilometers per
hour. Neutron stars are heavy.
Yeah, and it's moving fast.
They're massive, I should say.
Super neutron star. I think we have a title for today's episode of Geekspin.
Wow.
Wow. That's fast.
Yes.
So you don't want to faster
than any rocket that we've ever made.
You don't want to be in the way.
Way faster.
Well, if you were in the way, you'd have no way of getting out of the way.
How about it's ejected? Because, you know, equal and opposite. How fast is ejected going? I mean, if it's got like
ejecta,
a rocket
the
ejecta,
stuff the opposite direction,
I think it flew it.
Probably moved a lot faster. In fact, I think it's somewhere on the order of 80% of C.
Oh, wow.
In this particular case.
Okay.
Because you have to, if to get that so something like, that massive to go that fast, you have to get other stuff that's less massive going much faster.
So that's like 500 million miles per hour, the ejecta, if it's 80% FC.
That's really fast.
These are, oh my God.
Crazy speed. So we've got a super rocket.
And it has a plume because a lot of, oh, well.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome.
You can read the story and read more about it.
In fact, everything we talk about in a few minutes will be up on geekspeak.org. As soon as we have the podcast up, of course, everything's up. The Geeks Today, we're Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxell. You know, in the other room is Rick Philman. He answers phones every week for us here and throws in the information to us so we can take your calls. So thank you all for making Geekspeak possible. Hey, Geekspeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geekspeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. And you can do anything you'd like, just let them know the Geek sent you. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 and KOSP, Santa Cruz.